All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. And I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Here we go. Just follow us.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Some say I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Some say I'm ill.
Yeah.
Fuck you talking about.
Yeah.
Yo, chill.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
I ain't hard to find.
Yeah.
And I'm not like Sally.
Yeah.
I got a two-track mind.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Here's a little story.
Yeah.
About Sugar Steve.
Yeah.
She wanted diamonds.
Yeah.
Gave her the D.
Suprema. HR.
Suprema.
HR.
It's like,
yeah,
no time to rest.
Yeah.
It's time to learn,
yeah,
from hip hop's finest.
My name is Diamond.
Yeah.
My beast the best.
Yeah.
I'm down in the A now.
Yeah.
Chilling with my man Quest.
You like that reverb at the end?
Yeah,
that
was, yeah.
See, I'm
nice.
Learning a new button every week.
Wow.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. You know, we're down here in the A in Atlanta doing our first drafts of in-person episodes. It's been 3 years, and, you know, glad to be with the fam. Spoke to Unpaid Bill this morning.
Oh, how's he doing?
He's fine. He's chilling with Grover and Oscar and them on Sesame Street.
On a Saturday.
On a Saturday. Wait, today's Saturday?
Damn.
Right, right. Nah, when I got in the Uber this morning, I was like, oh, damn, it is Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's...
Mm-hmm. You go to work. You go to work.
It's Saturday?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, probably not when they're airing this, but yeah.
I'm just all messed up.
No more days of play.
Wait, I thought it was Thursday.
I know.
Damn. Okay, it's like that. Anyway, how you doing, Anya?
I am doing great. We back in the A. I barely recognize it. I ain't been here in 20 years. I love it.
I'm kind of mad because I'm here in the A, but I've yet to go to Strokers and probably.
Is that like a new with Strokers? I don't even, what the hell is that? I'm from the Magic City Gentlemen.
You know what's, okay, so this
Nikki
is what
Club
I'm,
Nikki.
This is what I'm learning about my Atlanta trip. Number one, you know, it was sort of a topic of the past, but now I get the feeling that people actually go to the strip clubs here just to eat.
So I heard Magic City's just up their menu.
Literally everyone behind the cameras was like,
"Yeah, ain't like I swear, like somebody said Magic City, they on Uber Eats."
I was like, "Nah, nobody used to want to eat in Magic City."
Magic City has the best wings ever.
I've heard.
I hear that Diamond D got really quiet when we started talking about it.
No, listen. All right, our guest today. I know I always say this, like this is one of my favorite shows. But any chance that I get to nerd out on the production techniques that really drew me to hip hop and drew all of us to hip hop, no matter who you're, like it's always a good episode. And so this gentleman has been a force to reckon with even before his solo career. Like the work that he's done, you know, is Strong City. Is Strong City at all associated with Aaron Fuchs?
No, not
anytime
at all.
I see the word
not
city, I just get.
I know, yeah.
And I'm afraid even if I say the label, it might get litigious. So
no, that was Jazzy J and Rocky Buchanan.
Right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah.
No affiliation, though.
Dog. The resume is strong. Like some of my favorite producer moments comes from this gentleman. Years. I mean, we all of his records. Stunts, Blunts, and Hip Hop. Hatred, I got to ask you about your sophomore, Hatred, right. Passion, and Infidelity, right. Like Time Piece, the Gotham, all, and now your brand new joint, The Riverview,
right.
Which is excellent work.
All right.
You've been doing quality, excellent work, and sometimes it's easy to sort of take for granted. People do excellent work, and they often get overlooked, and when top five lists and top 10 lists are named, and you know, sometimes a person's so effortless that you tend to forget their contributions, but you know, that's what Questlove Supreme is for. So that said, let's welcome the one and only, finally.
Man.
Diamond D. Wait, am I allowed to call you Diamond D now?
Of course.
Okay, number one.
Yes, what's that?
Can you please?
When were you never allowed?
No, but here's the deal. I have two versions of the album.
Okay.
When it was like Diamond D, Stump Lumps, and then right. There was Diamond.
Right. Well, it was Diamond and Psychic Neurotics.
Diamond
and Psychic Neurotics.
So what was the situation with your name? Was there another Diamond D like back in the day that I don't know about?
You know what? I'm not sure, but I think it might have been originally somebody that was signed to West End Records.
Oh, wow.
Out of New York.
Yeah. They did Tonic Gardner, Heartbeat. Like they was.
You know, Hot Shot was on that label. But I think somebody had the name, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, this is my favorite nerd out moments on Questlove Supreme. So I'm going to start from the beginning. What was your first musical memory? Time out. Let me go to OG style. Where were you born?
I was born in Manhattan, New York Hospital.
Wow, I never heard
Manhattan.
Any? Yeah,
born
Manhattan
in
gets
that,
a
yeah.
gets a. All right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. New York. All right. But, so what was your
raised
first
in the Bronx?
Okay.
All right.
Your first musical memory?
Sitting in my uncle's room and him just playing music. He had a large vinyl collection. So I would just sit in his room like 8, 9 years old and just listen to him play records.
What was he playing?
Everything. Mostly funk, jazz, soul. You know what I mean? Shouts out to Gary.
Was he very meticulous with the collection? Like I've had an older cousin that was that way, but you couldn't touch the wax and, you know, he's
definitely
like precious.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, you had to hold a record like this with both hands.
Right.
He was very meticulous about his vinyls.
Okay.
And then, you know, when I came along with the DJing, you know, we had to put our hands on the record.
I was going to say sometimes I try and explain to people the trouble. You know, I mean, it's easy now that hip-hop is in its, about to be in its 50th year.
Mm.
For us to also take for, you know, for granted its development and how, you know, far it's come. But, you know, I try to explain to people that a lot of those pioneers, you know, Flash got so much kickback, or pushback, if you will, you know, because the general idea was that you're going to destroy the needle or destroy the belt drive or the turntable, like
putting your fingers on the grooves. Those are big no-nos.
Yeah, I got punishment trying to, you know, like my first introduction to scratching, of course, was, you know, Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. Right. And you know, trying to practice on my dad's, you know, while he's not looking and see what happens and you get in trouble.
Right.
But yeah, like, how do you discover what that is in the Bronx, and were you like privy to any of those like block parties or anything?
Oh yeah, they were like right outside. You know,
explain it. Take us there.
Growing up in Forest Projects, me, Fat Joe, Lord Finesse, we would all see DJs like
y'all were in the same building, village,
same complex. Okay. But we would see guys like Grand Wizard Theodore, mainly Theodore. Sometime Flash, at that point, they were already making records, but we were able to just go downstairs and just see these jams going on in the parks.
What was it like seeing, because I'm assuming that you're too young for Harlem World?
Or, correct.
Right, so I'm assuming that you're a 11 or a 12-year-old.
Correct.
Seeing this, so what? How does the trickle effect happen to you? Like, were tapes a thing instantly, or how do you get the information?
Just watching it firsthand. You know, you've seen people out there, you know, with boxes, you know, recording or whatever, but we, you know, I saw it firsthand. You know, when Flash made Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, I had already seen him do some of that, you know, outside in the parks, cutting up Good Times, you know, shit like that. But just being close in proximity to it is what drew me. And in fact, Quest, when I was a little kid, whenever I saw the DJ reach for the Damn Right I'm Somebody album cover by the JBs, you know, I would lose my mind because I knew he was going to play Blow Your Head. And that stick, like, even now as an adult, that always sticks out to me. A lot of times people ask me, you know, what's the first song to draw you into hip-hop?
Right.
I mentioned Blow Your Head. It's not a rap record.
I know.
It's just a break beat that was real popular. And as little kids, we would lose our fucking mind when that shit came on.
Wow. So, all right. So Chuck D once explained to me the effect of that. Because I asked, like, why was that the first record that introduced the world to Public Enemy? And he explained to me that, you know, because, okay, I grew up with an old, like, a father and older uncles and older cousins.
Right.
And so they came more or less from the, I mean, I'm not saying like I inherited the critical thinking, but the way that, you know, I'm sure a classic album comes out, right, we all get together and discuss that shit critically. Mm-hmm. That's how they were, you know, because my dad was a musician and all that stuff. So in my household, James Brown was kind of over.
Correct.
By 73.
Okay, yeah.
Like, I distinctly remember the very first album my dad panned. Like, this is trash. He didn't like the Payback. Mm. I don't think he liked the idea of paying $15.90. So typically, I guess, back in 73, 74, an album would run $3.99. A single album's like $3.99, maybe $4.99.
Right, right.
So when you're paying $11, $12.99 for a double album, the first thing, and, you know, I'm 3 years old, but my dad's like, wait a minute. There's only 8 songs on this record, and it's a double record, and each song's like a meandering. I never knew what meandering was, but, like, by the time you get to, the, like, side three, time is running out fast, whatever, like 12 minutes, you know, he just took it off, and he's like, I don't like this. Right. And so in my mind, James Brown was over in 74, but Chuck D tells me, he's like, James Brown commercially might have had his last heyday of string, you know, after Papa Don't Take No Mess, but he's like, in the hood, we never stopped playing Goodfoot and get, if anything, like, we brought those singles back, but it was just hood stuff. But for some reason, me myself, I never liked Blow Your Head because in my mind, I imagined James Brown's like, okay, so Stevie Wonder got a Moog and made miracles of it.
That's funny.
With him, it was almost like I could see like the bubble wrap on the floor. And him just, and this is the thing, even James Brown's musicians himself will say, like, he was the worst soloist of all time.
Correct. Yeah.
But
yeah,
one of those guys where even if he's wrong, he's right. So for him to do like all this like crazy soloing and whatnot,
right,
just never understood why y'all gravitated to that record.
Right.
It's just to have an instrumental that was fast to let B-boys go off or.
Yeah, that's all it was. You know, I'm a little kid, so I'm not really thinking about the musicality of it.
Right.
But just the effect that record had when it was played at parties, like, you know, people would lose their fucking minds, you know, just that little one part.
Mm-hmm.
To touch on what you're saying, I did read where Fred Wesley said that James went in there behind their backs and he put that Moog sound on.
Overdub, yeah.
Wow. Right. He said it wasn't on there at first.
Yeah.
But the irony is that that's what drove it. Mm-hmm. By the time these young black and brown kids were listening to it, you know, in 78 and 79 at these parties.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're now an iHeart affiliate, and so we're like limited on the times that we can play songs, but just for that you people know what we're talking about, this is Blow Your Head.
Oh, thank y'all. So y'all was talking about that. Yeah, we know that. Public Enemy number. Okay, thank
right,
you.
Exactly.
We all like, okay, God, we here now. We here.
Yeah, so, you know, but this is also what I want to know. Do you have any memories? Because this is kind of the one thing that hip-hop pioneers really don't talk about. But, I mean, I can only put two and two together that if it weren't for the blackout of 77, we might not have had hip-hop culture. Because I'm just assuming that because of the looting...
Oh, yeah.
I'm a little kid during the blackout. But
No. I'm not saying were you
wait,
there.
But I have heard stories about a lot of equipment came right. into possession during the blackout. So, you know, it definitely pushed it along a little bit.
Right.
But I mean, it was there before that.
But what I want to know is how, because I'm also aware that as the years and decades go by,
right.
maybe revisionist history sets in and stories get exaggerated. But how officially loud were these speakers at these block parties? Were they like concert level size, or were you loud guys enough, just satisfied with
loud enough where you can hear them three blocks away?
How do you get power electricity in a park?
Street lights, I believe.
Okay, from lampposts.
So someone had to risk their life, climb up a lamppost, or
buildings. A lot of them knew about equipment, so they would break into a lamppost, get the power lines, and do some shit. And the next thing you
now,
know,
I wish we had Kwame's dad here to explain.
Right.
Kwame, Kwame's dad used to tell, like, for the longest, Kwame's father would steal the neighbor's gas. Like, he knew how to run a line inside of their basement or whatever, and just
resourceful. Resourceful people.
Exactly.
Oh, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you when you officially, when you considered yourself like, all right, I'm going to get into this music shit. Like, how old were you?
I would say about 12. About 12 when I asked my mom to buy me some turntables. Yeah.
Did you want a DJ or you just
Yeah, no, I was. I wanted to be a DJ. Oh,
okay.
I didn't care about rhyming. I just, you know, I was... My whole focus was the beats, the break beats. I would just go to these jams, just stand by the ropes and try to see album covers. You know, just how they find these little parts with the drums. That's what really, like, intrigued me. You know, all of these records with these little drum parts. So I was just drum crazy.
When you were a kid, what was the record store that was, like, the go-to?
The Wiz.
Nobody beats
the Wiz.
The Wiz, and there was another store on Third Avenue. I don't remember the name, but the first break I bought was Shangri-La.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But we called it Paradise Is Very Nice. And Irv Gotti, he mentioned it in the documentary. He said he used to cut that as a kid, and I was like, oh, shit, that's crazy. But yeah, that was the first joint I bought with my own money.
So this Shangri-La...
Yeah.
So that's the Slick Rick.
No, that's Frisco Disco.
That's Frisco Disco.
But De La Soul sampled this on something.
So in your mind, what was it about it? Because in your mind, wasn't that disco? Wasn't disco off limits? Or
No. A lot of breaks was disco. You know that? Super Sperm was disco. Frisco Disco. The Mexican. It's just begun.
So whatever kept people dancing long, that was good enough for you.
I mean, you know, as long as the break was there. All I Need Is You Tonight by Arthur Prysock. Yo, a lot of disco joints. Cerrone was a disco record. Rockin' in the Pocket.
Really?
That's a disco record.
Wow. Okay, wait a minute. All right, so would you spin it on 33 or 45?
Well, I mean, 45, if you want to rhyme to it, but on 33, it speeds up.
Right, okay.
It's a disco record. Cerrone is a disco artist.
I didn't know that Rockin' in the Pocket sped up. I'm one of those people, at least with the basic breaks, especially with the stuff that's more disco-fied. Like, I mean, there's two ways to listen to it. Right. And I'm, like, the first maybe 20 years of my life, I'm very guilty of needle dropping.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a drum. And then
right.
But then, you know, those that are really into it, they study the song to figure it. So, like, what is your process of how much patience do you have? So when you go and you bend shop and you get coming with 400 joints or whatever,
right?
Then is it like wine? Do you just let it sit there until you get to it? Or
it all depends on how intense
how much patience do you have to, like, no,
they're not going to sit there too long. You know, they're going.
But in your mind, is there always a part that's usable, and you figure out? Because maybe with Dilla, so Dilla told me Dilla never made a beat on a Sunday.
Okay.
And he would house clean and do chores or whatever, and just have records on.
Okay.
And he said he'd do about 3 or 4 hours or whatever. You know, sometimes he'll record some shit and just listen in the car
just
and drive
to
around.
It, yeah.
So. Yeah, like, are you one of those people that, like, you'll listen to something over and over again until it hits you, or you just...
Nah, I just go through it when I'm near. But when I'm near, I'm focused.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you gotta change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
How did you make the transition from, you know, DJing to then making tracks, producing?
Well, most producers started off as DJs.
Right.
But to answer your question, I would say like around 1990 when me and Premier did Law Finesse's first album, The Funky Technician.
Well, before that, it was Master Rob, I'm Not Playing.
Well, I didn't produce that, but I bought the record.
Ah, okay.
I didn't know how to program. Jazzy J programmed it.
Oh, okay.
And I said, yo, Jay, loop this part up.
The Albert
King. Bring this back for the hook. You know, put these guitars in the chorus.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to work it.
So I got to ask you this question.
Of course.
And you know I'm about to ask you. Okay, so for me, you know, and outside of New York, you know, I grew up in a 3,000 record household, of which, you know, truthfully, maybe only 10, maybe 15% appealed to me.
Okay.
And the rest was just my dad's boring stuff. Like, I'm not listening to Arthur Prysak and the Beatles and all this other stuff. But, of course, you know, once I hear Nation of Millions, then suddenly, like, I'm like, oh, that's dad stuff. That's that.
Right.
Now it's like I got to go through all them records, and then I discovered, like, oh, God, this is how they make hip-hop.
Right.
So here's the deal. So I became a Bomb Squad junkie.
Okay, me too.
And, I mean, for me, there's nine seminal, even though they've done more, but to me, they've done nine important documents as far as, like, their canon.
Okay.
And really, like, sampling laws kind of killed them off. And, you know, there's other inner issues in the group, but for real, it's like, for me, it was always, you know, Bun Rush, Nation, Black Planet. I do count, because they did a majority of it, Poison by BBD.
Correct.
Even the non-Bomb Squad sounds, songs sounded like them. Of course, America's Most Wanted. And for me...
Justify My Love.
Yeah. Wow. And I now consider, you know, Terminator's first joint.
Beats.
Yeah, but the last two records in their canon that I consider part of that document, of course, was Young Black Teenagers and Son of Berserk. Yeah. Now, when I heard Are You With Me, I thought that was like just one of the most craziest things I ever heard in my life. But
me too.
Didn't realize that they just
put the needle on my record.
Right. I was like, wait, you can sample. It was so meta. Like, they sampled a sample of you.
I didn't understand that.
So when you heard it, what
when
were you
I heard
thinking?
That, I flipped the fuck out. But you
so
know,
so it wasn't an honor, like, oh my God, Chuck
Daniels. It was mixed feelings, honestly. But I turned to Jazzy J and I said, yo, these dudes just basically just rhymed over the instrumental.
So
you know, but listen, Strong City was distributed by Uni.
Right.
Son of Berserk was signed to Uni.
Yeah.
But still, that's the master. How the publishing get worked out?
Let me play the 10 seconds I could play.
Okay. That's my fucking record.
Meanwhile, I'm dreaming, like, damn, I wonder what part Eric Satie did, like, because I see the Bomb Squad just as some synesthesia, like, the way that the guitar stems are made. And then I heard what you did, and I was like, oh, damn. Right. They just took Diamond's joint and looped it.
Right.
So what happened when you heard that?
I went to Jazzy J. I pointed it out to him.
Right.
Because, you know, he had a vested interest in it, and it never went further than that. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened with that. I don't even know if we were credited on the publishing side. I just never looked back.
Wow. What was, at that time, I've read, you did an interview, this was years ago. Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about Wild Pitch and Stu Fine. At the time, what was he like as a businessman? How did the Wild Pitch business structure work?
Well, you know, Stu Fine, I'm gonna give Stu his props. You know, he signed Gangstar, he signed Lord Finesse, he signed Lord Professor and Main Source, Chill Rob G. Mm-hmm. You know, Stu Fine and his wife Amy Fine, they had a good ear. They had a good ear for good hip hop. Stu never really did anything personally toward me, but being around my man Lord Finesse and listening to his grumblings, you know, if your man grumbling about something, you're going to grumble too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, you know, yeah, I took that shot. I made that one line at him.
Don't
want to
make a pitch as wild.
He didn't really do anything to me, but,
But
just listening to Lord Finesse grumble all the time, yo, I'd be like, damn, word? You know.
Ah, man.
But shouts out to Stu Fine. You know, he actually...
I'm 10 seconds years old.
He actually
old
threw me a pass later on in life on his LL track that I did. Anyway.
Is he still alive? Is Stu still alive?
I believe he is. I'm not sure. Wow. I'm not sure. But Wild Pitch has a legacy.
They do.
Nah, straight up.
You know. I'm leaving off some artists too, but yeah.
45 King. Well, no. I mean he did
Gangstar's Busta Move.
Busta Move Boy. You know what? Stu gave me two men back when Search was working at Wild Pitch.
See that?
Yeah, Search was like briefly, I guess he signed OC to Wild Pitch, correct?
Correct. I left out OC, that's right.
Yeah. And
a lot of great artists.
We were shooting Silent Treatment on my birthday, and Search hit me off with two mint copies of Busta Move Boy.
Nice.
But I let them sit on a radiator, so it's warped.
Oh, wow.
Right. Shut up, Steve.
It's over.
You got to take care of your records,
Shut
man.
Shut up, man. All right, damn. So,
it was interesting. Premier wasn't producing yet.
Yeah. The pre-premiere right. Gangstar.
But I was a 45 King fan, so... You know, he's one of my mentors too.
That was my joint. Okay, before I get, you know, I became aware of you, even though I knew of you and didn't know of you because on cassettes, they really weren't putting on credits and all those things. And, you know, I primarily brought my joints on cassettes, but.
Did you leave those on the radiator too?
Yes, I did. but can you tell me about the environment of, like, the record conventions and, you know.
Friendly competition.
Okay, just take me, when you, just hypothetically walk me through.
And y'all are talking about, like, vinyl conventions.
So
like
they would set up record conventions in, like, hotels, like Hotel Pennsylvania. And
you used to go there.
The Roosevelt, also. Yeah. So you find out a record convention is coming.
Right.
What time do you want to get there? And who's waiting in line already before you get there?
I mean, you're liable to see anybody. You know, we there at 7 a.m. Kid Capri, Buck Wild, Lord Finesse, Rashad Smith, Jerobi, Q-Tip. You know, Dilla was there a few times. Pete Rock, your man Prince B.
I heard Prince B.
I heard Prince B would get there early and, yeah.
No, Prince B, you know why he was winning? Cause he didn't negotiate. He didn't haggle. We all negotiating with dealers. Mm. Prince B, 800? All right. You know. So they loved him.
On the mic.
So they would set stuff aside for him.
Yeah, they loved him. Everybody else was like, yo, 8. How about 7?
Yeah.
You know, we all in there trying to cut deals, but Prince B, I give him his props. You know,
he had
no
it, I die without you money. He was good.
Right.
Okay, you know. So It's friendly competition, but still the Wild West.
Right.
And you guys are panning for gold.
Mm. That's it.
In your mind, do you already know the dealer you want to go to? Like, how do you, without the aid of
the computer
and all that stuff, how do you know?
After you've gone a few times, you pretty much know what dealers you really want to rock with. My man John, 88 Keys, he used to be up under John all the time. I forgot my man. What's my man's name? Bleecker Street Bob, black dude.
Yeah, Bleecker Street Bob.
I remember him. I remember my man Bob from Boston. Mm-hmm. Me and Kid Capri, we like Bob from Boston. Bob had the official. I don't know where he was getting these joints from, you know. But a lot of good memories. I remember when The Power of Zeus was out.
Okay.
And everybody was on the prowl for that. But I remember one year when it first came to our attention, it might have been like 20 copies there. And, you know, we all, you know, everybody that was in the know, we all got one. But those are good memories. I remember them days forever.
I was going to say, without, you know, like, I'll say the generation after you, which I guess that's where I come to play or whatever, but... You know, we were always going on these wild goose chases because of the whole biz. I don't even have to say it, but, you know, searching for these bellless.
Mardi Gras.
Yeah, Mardi Gras.
That was
but
the record.
But what was a real record that was just like you heard about? And I don't mean like the fake bellless Mardi Gras shit, but like what was a real like
record that y'all were like, you heard about or that sort of thing that you just had to get?
It varied from digger to digger, but for me, it was the Whip of Jenny album by Dave Matthews. Dave Matthews was...
And not Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, yeah. No.
But James Brown's Doom. Former... Yeah, she's Doom. Like, Matthews, I knew that. Yeah. Look at this.
James Brown's former
musical
composer.
Director. Yeah.
Okay. He was also attached to the Dee Feliz Trio.
Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form. But he put out an album on People Records. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
It's the only psychedelic funk album that was on People Records. So that was like always on my list.
Besides the Show Is Funky Down Here record?
Yeah, okay. But that was James Brown.
Right.
But this was like an offshoot.
That is crazy.
Which made it even more rare.
See, that's another one. So Christian McBride, jazz guy bassist, his uncle was also James Brown freak and worked at a jazz station.
Okay.
And we were in high school together. Mm. So we always had, Chris had Whip of Jenny and had Show Is Funky Down Here.
That's the rare albums. Well,
right,
the
but
Whip of Jenny.
We put them joints on, I was like, this is horrible.
That's
the thing, we were never in the mind space of something's on here that we can loop and make it work. And only when I became older, I was like, so many joints on here.
Yo, can I ask a really maybe dumb fundamental crate digging question to
There's
both of
y'all?
There's
never any dumb questions. Right.
Okay, because I never understood how you set the price point and how you know. I mean, I know rare issues are rare issues, but how you know that this record is worth this?
What they say it's worth it.
Yes. How do you know? And especially when you just starting out, how do you? And then is it a learning process?
It comes with years of digging. You know, albums you see often compared to ones you don't.
Okay.
But it's also, he's okay. So there's. Maybe I should explain it at the top of the show that what makes Diamond unique is, so the first generation of sampling, of course, you know, this is why I always shout out Breakbeat Lou. Right. Breakbeat Lou basically took the fundamentals, like the easy stuff, Funky Drummer, Impeach the President, like beats that you've always heard all your, you know, life on those early records, like up until the Marley Marl, Rick Rubin period. So like up until 86, 87. So I'll say like what we call the classic period of hip hop between 87, kind of 90.
Yeah, the Bomb Squad era.
Right. What Breakbeat Lou would do was basically just make these compilation records, put seven songs on each record, and then you buy that record and then you sample it.
Right.
Made it easy for dweebs like me. So I didn't have to go spend hours in a Goodwill, and I could just cheat and get the Wikipedia version of these joints.
Mm-hmm.
So then, Diamond's part of what I call the first wave of Renaissance beat makers, in which it's almost equivalent to, so basically there's a collective of producers that are like, yo, we ain't gonna do the Captain Obvious shit and sample James Brown and Funky Drummer.
Right.
We're gonna do the hard shit and go in our parents' record collection and get this old, you know, Galt McDermott record. And so they made art out of, we were taking the chitlins, like the part of the carcass that, you know.
Right.
So y'all also made those prices go up too as the years went by.
Correct.
But that's
right.
But the thing is that I want to know, now once y'all, for me, once they use some shit, now, I'm the next generation after him. So when I go to the sound library, Monty Alexander's Love and Happiness.
The Happiness, yeah.
That's a great example. So after the Beatnuts use that, suddenly that Monty Alexander record is $75.
Mm-hmm.
And
but even before that, when Tip used it on Gangsta Bitch.
Yeah, yeah.
It was on the radar.
So
for those who know,
she set me up for a good alley-oop though. So what I'm asking is, were records super expensive if it hadn't been used yet? All right. So say like there's a time before, let's say in '89, Eugene McDaniels, where no one has sampled that record yet before Tribe.
Right.
Are you still paying $150 for it? Because after Tribe used it, this is $150.
Right.
To a jazz collector, yes. If I'm a jazz collector, I'm not concerned what hip hop is doing. It's still a good body of work. It's vinyl. Eugene McDaniels, he only made a handful of albums, so, you know, it would still be worth money. It all depends on the individual.
Okay.
What's the most you spent on a record? Yeah, what'd you use for it? What'd you use it for?
Give me your top five most expensive joints.
Man, I don't even know, Quest. The Whip of Jenny, that was one of them.
Okay.
Because I was looking for that. I don't know. I just have no clue
what the most expensive. Like, I'm like, how far can it go? Can it be $15,000?
I mean, look on Discogs.
Yeah.
You know?
I think.
It doesn't have to be a break beat. It could just be something that's a collector's item.
Yeah. I'll say. Well, definitely. You know, like, quality records are like 75. I'm trying. Maybe there was one. There's one ridiculous. Like, normally, if it's mint condition, then it's whatever. Like, someone tried to get me, you know, like maybe 200 for back before they reissued the Sweet Charles.
Okay.
And you were one of the first ones.
Right.
But you were one of the first ones.
No, that was a break. No, yo, I heard ever outside talk, in the parks.
Did Pharrell ever talk to you about that?
No, not yet.
Oh, man. Like, so for him, the Shut the Fuck Up interlude was his favorite joint on
Stunts and Blunts.
So, him making Drop Down and Get Your Ego On, the follow-up to Hot in Here, Nelly's joint. Like, he was like, that was me trying to do my Diamond G joint.
That was
like his homage.
Well, he always showed me love, but he never told me that story yet.
Wow. Yeah. How did you get signed, get your deal as a MC, you know, to make your first record?
I was actually doing a demo deal for an artist they wanted to sign. The artist's name was Joe Control.
Okay.
So, yeah, I was just making the beats for him, like a two demo deal, and I rhymed on one of them. So,
what were you making your tracks on at that time?
Say it again.
What were you making your tracks on? Making
your equipment
at that time?
Yeah, yeah.
I had a Kai 900, just a sample.
Everyone has it, yeah.
And I had an HR16 Elises.
Wow. Okay.
But the Elises, it has 16 pads on it. You know, eight. Mm-hmm. So I had 16 triggers on the sample. On the sampler.
How many seconds? Oh, with the 900 sample.
Oh, plenty. No, I you know, I did my album on that. I made Flojo on that. The score, Punks Jump Up to Get Beat Down. Anything between 92 to 96, I was still using that.
Wait a minute. You got to answer this question. Now, I know, like, well, first I want to know, is it safe to say that you were Jazzy J's apprentice, like his protege?
No doubt. No
All
question.
Right, so you're first generation Zulu. That said, please tell me, what is the drum machine that he used on Suicide for Busy B?
That was the SB-12.
No, that's not a stock joint. You trying to tell me that's a stock?
The SB-12.
Oh, the SB-12.
Not the 1200. The 12. With the floppy just looked like a 7-inch.
Dog.
Okay, I sat there and I watched Jay take Funky Drummer. 1, 2, 3, 4, ding, link, ding, link.
Right.
Right. I lost my mind, yo.
Man.
Yeah, that.
I lost my mind.
Yeah.
And I just gave it away, but.
No, I mean, that's basic, Jordan.
Right.
So your first deal, how you signed, how you were doing the demo deal for.
Okay, for Stunts Blunts or Strong City.
Well, yeah, I guess start with Strong City.
For Strong City?
Mm-hmm.
The MC in the group, his name was Rob. Rob came to my house and said, yo, I seen Jazzy J in the projects. I said, nah, you lying. He said, nah, he right over there now. So I go downstairs. Sure enough, Jay had on the first generation Def Jam jackets, the satin joints, all purple. And we met him. You know, this is around the time when, this is a little bit after, Jazzy J had a song called Cold Chillin'
in the Spot.
Right. With
Cold Rock stuff.
Yes, yes.
Russell Rush.
Yeah, with Russell, yeah.
Where he just talked trash on the
Right.
That's my shit.
So, you know, he actually helped put Def Jam on the map. Along with It's Yours. And I believe he did
I need a beat.
I believe he did I Need a Beat. Mm-hmm. You know, but anyway, we go over there and we meet him and come to find out. He's friends with a female in the projects. And he gave us his number and We went to see him a few weeks later and just developed a relationship. And then he eventually signed us.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's how it happened. You know, my man saw him in the Jex.
That was around what year?
Oh, that was like 88.
Okay, that's 88.
Yeah, 88, definitely.
And then from there, from that situation, how did you make it to, you know, Mercury to being, you know, doing something?
Okay,
else?
So after the Ultimate Force came out, didn't really blow up, but, you know, we made some noise regionally.
Man, they used to play that record in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Like,
oh,
they,
word?
Bro,
okay.
It was a show they used to have on North Carolina. A&T was the black college in Greensboro where I grew up, called the Full Moon Block Party. And they would play I'm Not Playing. And I didn't find out it was, you know, you till like years later. I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. But I used to love that record, man. I was like 9.
Yeah. No, that's the first record to incorporate the blues.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I used to cut doubles of that. The beginning, Albie King.
Right.
I found it going through my grandfather's records. He had one. Mm-hmm. This is like maybe like 84.
Right.
So my first year of high school, but I'm actively looking for beats. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh shit, this is nice. And then maybe a year later I caught another one, but I used to cut it. So when we got through Jazzy J, I said, yo, we gonna flip this right here, because, you know, nobody really fucking with the blues, and you know, it's a funky beat. But that's how I got signed to Strong City. How I got signed to for the Stunts Blunts, I was doing a demo for somebody. I rhymed on it. So about a month later, they call us down there. So I'm like, okay, I'm about to get a check for these motherfucking beats. So I go down there like, all right, yeah, what's up? You know, da da da. They like, yo, we want to sign you. I was like, me? Oh, that's what's up. All right, you know, yeah. Let's do it. I wasn't even really looking for the deal, but
who was the A&R at the time? Do you know?
Brian Chin.
Oh, Brian Chin.
Yeah, he was a big shot over at Priority.
Yeah,
he signed Special Ed, all of those groups over there. Brian Chin. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a little harsh to the MC that I was doing the demo for, but I think they might have just broke him up with some money or something. But yeah, actually the deal just kind of fell in my lap. But yeah. Brian Chin, he liked the music, and he liked what I was rhyming, you know, what I was rhyming. So,
and you really didn't have any intentions of rhyme, like being an MC. Like,
nah, that was just something I did.
Yeah, yeah.
But around this time, I'm around Lord Finesse almost every day. I'm around Grand Poobah Maxwell, because he was signed to Strong City also in a group called the Masters of Ceremonies. Mm-hmm. So
they were in Strong City.
That's right. Sexy, Cracked Out.
Right.
That was okay. Strong City.
Yeah, so okay.
I'm around these dudes, and, you know, it's just rubbing off on me. Even though my thing is DJing and still making beats, but I knew how to rhyme. And one of the first demos I recorded was Best Kept Secret. And then when they heard that, they said, okay, we're going to do an album on you.
Okay. Yeah. How long did it take for you to make that record? How long?
Stunts Blunts?
Yeah, yeah.
About 8 months.
And at that time, were they with samples and stuff? Was it just, you know, Wild Wild West shit, just whatever, or how did y'all handle it?
It's just a collection of records that,
in terms of clearances, like clearance samples, was they?
Well, I didn't care about that. That was a label's job.
Yeah.
You know, at that, you know, back then, you just turn it in, give them the names, you know, the names you want to give them. And,
that part,
but. What I want to know is, were you conscious, at least, to avoid Ultimate Beats and Breaks?
Oh, definitely.
Because the part I didn't get out was, the, you know, again, like, the reason why you're part of the way, and the Renaissance guys is, you know, there's Premier, yourself, Wash Professor.
That's after Stunts Blunts.
Ali and Tip.
That's after Stunts Blunts.
Right, but I just meant when we're talking about the what I consider the people that went outside the circle, what I call the Ivy League circle of sampling, where you guys are now acquiring records that aren't easily available.
Right.
That's what stands you guys apart. But back then, was it just a general rule like, nope, no more Ultimate Beats and Breaks, no easy James Brown shit. Like, I got to find some shit that no one has and make some shit out of that.
I don't know if it was general, but amongst that core group of diggers, we had already progressed. And, you know, me living in the Bronx, a lot, like you said, a lot of the beats that Lou was putting on them records, we already knew about.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, well, fuck what you heard. I said, people always say, hey, we like the way you make beats. He doesn't use break beats.
Right.
That wasn't a jab at Lou. That was just me being honest.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, but.
But it pushed the envelope further.
Correct.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
So in your mind, who of the initial Renaissance crew? And I'm talking Pete, I'm talking Premier, Tippin Ali, Large Professor. Like, who did you consider, like, real nice with theirs? Like, whew, I gotta... Like, did anyone ever flip some shit?
I'm answer
like,
the question. I gotta start with Prince Paul for his work on De La Soul's first album, which really showed me, because at that point it was a lot of James Brown, as you know, Quest. Mm. But that De La album in 89, it opened the doors for me. Like, you know, there's so much other stuff out here that I knew about but really wasn't on my radar. So I gotta shout out Prince Paul. Of course, Tribe Called Quest, their first albums. Jungle Brothers. All these albums influenced me. Out of the members you just named, obviously Pete Rock's first album. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And the work that me and Showbiz was doing. So, you know, you just take all of that in. And then...
Has there ever been a moment where... And again, like, you know, I'm listening to it. Like, I don't have a deal yet. Right. So anything you guys are doing are like, oh, man, this man is from heaven. But I know that there comes a time where like, ah, man, I had that record. I should have used it first or whatever. Like, has there ever been that moment of like, ah, they got to it before I did? Or
yes, it's been times like that. Yeah.
All right, and I know record?
I've used joints that people ran behind me and used.
Oh, yeah. I was going to like New York
and
shit.
And were bigger than when I did it.
What joints?
New York shit. Buster.
Fuck.
Yeah. That's one example.
Yeah.
That's one example.
But I consider that an homage joint. Like, if 15 years go by.
He told me that's what it was. Damn.
Oh, it's definitely that.
Yeah,
it's
just the two of us, Chubb Rock.
Yeah.
It was, you know.
DJ Scratch said when he did that, He had never heard I went for mine before.
What?
He said he was on the road DJing for the Hit Squad in 92, and Stunts Blunts wasn't on his radar. I couldn't call dude a liar.
Yeah.
You know, Chubb Rock, mm-hmm. he used the Albert King joint
right.
after
Justice
me.
Over, yeah.
Dos Effects, they want effects. I used that for Law That's Finesse right. first.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, I can go on
that.
And on.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that one.
Yeah, I think in general, a lot of people when they create, like, I think there are people that are creators and then people are listeners.
Right.
Like, I'm a listener.
Right.
So I'll absorb it. But yeah, oftentimes I'll meet creators that aren't hip to, but that's in all parts of music, you know?
Yes.
You know, I would ask the Revolution, like, was Prince sitting around like, ah, damn, I got to beat Thriller. And like that sort of thing. Like, was he? And I think Lisa told me, like, Prince listened to Thriller, like, for the first time in its completion. Like, I think when they were on, when the last tour, like the Parade tour in 86. Right. But for the most part, they had to put him on to shit.
Right.
My actually, joint off the record, my favorite joint off Stunts Blunts was Check 1-2. That was like...
Yeah, that's my favorite joint too.
Really?
Yeah, just the feel of it.
Yeah, and like I always, the thing I always like about you, because, you know, I think with producers, I think there's something about producers that rhyme, that y'all have an understanding of just really using y'all voices as an instrument and like complimenting a beat rather than just, I'm going to bar you the fuck up, you know what right. I mean? Like you, Pete... Dilla, rest in peace. Like, you know, y'all all had a thing. And so I wanted to ask you about one of my favorite verses of yours, like ever. It wasn't even on your album. Mm-hmm. The way you started off Runaway Slave, Still Digging, going
mm-hmm.
back on the block with My Name Ain't Quincy.
Right, right.
What do you remember about that session? Or in the making of that album? Because that's like, in terms of y'all's crew, like that album.
Those were good times.
Yeah.
You know, we were all in the studio together. I wrote it on the spot.
Okay.
You know, and Quincy had that album out back on the block, you know, so it was a cultural reference, you know, a pop cultural reference. Yeah, I mean, shit, it's crazy. Those a lot of good memories, yeah. You know, back when we were just all forming. We had already known each other for years. We all grew up with each other. But around that time, we was like, yo, you know, we can all come together, try to form, you know, and make a statement. You know, and I would definitely say DITC definitely pushed the culture forward as far as, you know, trying to dig for music that wasn't touched already.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to stand apart.
I'll say the first time I was really aware of your existence, like for real, of course, is in a lot of us, it was show business on The Low End Theory.
Correct.
How did that come?
That's crazy.
There?
You know, I went there to play beats for Tip. I had chopped
just to play him some beats to.
Yeah, I went. You know, I went there. I chopped up this Jimi Hendrix joint, and he was really feeling it. And he knew I had a deal. Mm-hmm. And Pooh Bah was on the track originally, mm-hmm. and the label felt he said some things he shouldn't have said, and Tip said, yo, Pooh, you know, I really want you on here, but the label wants you to, you know, change your verse up.
Okay.
And, you know, Pooh Bah 91, 92, Pooh Bah was like, I ain't changing shit.
Couldn't tell him anything. You're right.
You know what I mean? Now, the guards, Sadat X and Jamal, they like, shit, we want to be on this fucking record. You know, we love Tribe. So while I'm near, Tip is like, yo, you want to be on the joint? I'm like, hell yeah. You know what I mean? And I wrote it on the spot.
That's a notable, I mean, even though it's not a debut.
Right.
But for a lot of us, we feel like that was like
that preceded my album.
Right.
So it was like an alley oop.
It was a great setup. It was a great setup.
Yeah.
You know what, kids?
What's up? Uncle?
It's time for the return of...
Oh, yes,
you thought I was going to have you thought we was going to have him on the show and not do a round of Bitch You Guessed
It? Kid, it's been a minute.
All right, so I do this to every beat maker that I respect.
Okay.
In which, you know, again, I'm adhering to the rules.
No, you're doing good. I'm just making sure they're listening.
I know. It's like, I feel like there's like 42 lawyers in the... Already cleared it with Jake. He knows what time it is. We good. All right, so one, I'm going to upgrade the game because Fonte always insists on playing.
I'm not playing. I ain't gonna play.
No, I'm gonna let you win this too because I've upped the game. This is what happens when you're in quarantine and COVID. You think of new ways to
new rules.
So I'm the bitch who can't guess it here. Is that the idea?
Yeah, everybody can all play of you, me? All of you in. All right. So what I'm gonna do is I'm going to play a list of Captain Obvious songs, of which I've isolated a specific part to see if you can identify the sample. I think you're up for this. This one's very easy. And I will allow two clues because, you know.
Yeah, I need it. That's all right.
All right, let's go.
All right. Sample number one. What is this sample? And I've detuned it to throw you off. Let me know when you need a clue.
I don't even know what detuning means, so.
Oh, that's I know what it is. It's Walk On By, right? Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yes. Nice.
Okay. Here we go. Detuned. Number two.
Oh, I got that.
Say it. If you know, say it.
I'm not right. I was like, is a ball involved?
No.
Okay. Sounds like Boss. I don't know why I thought that song.
I don't know what that is. Okay.
Okay, let me.
Okay.
Is that Brenda?
Oh, okay. No, I wouldn't.
Brass Construction's The Messenger, used on NWA's I Ain't the One. All right, that was a little advanced. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Number three.
Not with a piece. I don't know what that is.
Hold on. Oh, it's Scarface used it for Money and the Power. I don't know the original break. Yeah.
Love Serenade, Barry White. Damn, maybe I made this a little too advanced.
It was detuning. It was detuning.
Yeah. You
see, I gotta throw off the smell first, man.
Yeah.
I want to come out the gate, Captain
like
Obvious.
I like.
All right,
like,
here we go. Number four.
Is that I hear the end of that snare. It's a Good Old Time Funkadelic.
Yeah. Don't say nothing. Okay. That's the Funkadelic.
Yes. Good old music.
Good old music.
I was like, good old music.
Yeah, yes, you're correct. Time. That is
Magic Tones first. Right. By the Magic Tones.
All right. Yes, you're right.
Boing.
I just found that 45. I was like, what the fuck?
Both on Westbound. So.
Right. And that's even better. Yes, that is even better. And I got to talk to you about your 45 game. All right. This is number five.
Is that James Brown?
Nope.
That's Bill Withers. It's Harlem.
Close, yeah. Use me.
Use me.
You
okay,
okay, was right.
I was in
Damn.
The neighborhood.
What the fuck in the detune? I don't.
All right, let me not detune it to not throw you off.
No, I like the detune.
You winning.
Okay, why?
Can everybody get a fair chance sometime?
All right.
These, you know, I mean, you know, of course, I just detuned
I got
them,
that one
and
if it wasn't detuned.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. I think you could too, Dino.
Number six.
I don't know this one. That bongo. It's not
Steve, you don't know this?
Oh, it's jazz.
Look, no.
Steve. Oh, okay. You asked Steve.
It's not Minnie. It ain't Minnie. I have no idea. Is it Mavis Staples?
Ah, crazy. Eddie Kendricks.
Ah.
Wow.
Eddie Kendricks.
Yeah. The little snippets, like, you know, that's why he won't play 2 seconds.
Well, I'm only allowed to play 2 seconds, so.
Right. That's like a half of a second. I think.
All right, see, now I feel bad for this next one because it's only the reverb, but all right, I won't detune this one.
See. Every song I hear is, I think it's Brenda Russell.
I mean, that's a really good guess, though.
That's what I keep thinking. Oh, that ain't, no, that ain't.
I have no idea what this is. I don't know this one.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Grace Jones, Nightclubbing.
I don't know that one.
Good one. Good.
I didn't even know she was the first one to do that. I didn't even know that.
That's her record.
That's her record.
I did not know that.
Shout out to Sly and Robbie.
Right. That's right.
So
the Kings.
I would say that when Miles Davis' ex-wife, Betty Davis, she signed to Island Records in 77 to make a fourth record. That was supposed to make her a star, but because she's so headstrong and producing and writing her own joints, he dropped her. And then Chris Blackwell.
Okay.
And then, you know, she just faded into obscurity. But basically, Sly and Robbie had brought Grace to his attention. And instead, he signed Grace Jones to Island Records. And
oh, crazy.
The Nightclub was supposed to be Betty Davis's record?
I mean, not. Wow. I don't know. Chris definitely had visions on what he wanted her to do. Right. But, like, part of her story was, like, I write and I control. She got the Commodores record. Like, I didn't realize, like, it was her songs for the Commodores that got them a deal with Motown. They offered her a deal, and she's like, do I own my publishing? They're like, nope. Yeah. She wrote that Harlem song that I used for the Chambers Brothers. Like, she wrote a whole bunch of songs, but then they'd be like, yo, you want a deal? And she's like, if only I own my music 100%. So because she was so headstrong on her joint, she kind of got blackballed. Yeah. All right, these are my last two.
Okay.
And I won't detune it. Number eight.
This game's freaking me out.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's two events.
Let's go. Let's see. Oh, that's Famous Heroes, Eugene McDaniels. Yeah, that's
Eugene McDaniels, Freedom Death Dance. All right. This is one that all of you should know. And I am detuning because I feel like it's Captain Obvious.
Sly Stone?
Close, but no.
I'm out. The airport? Oh.
Is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 Pointer Sisters? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I could tell in your eyes, Laia, that you kind of knew where it was. All right, I will go home and retool my game. Damn it.
No, it was fun. Has anybody won this outside of Fonte? Any of our guests? Do you remember?
Fonte always beats them all. I mean, I think Blaze was the closest.
Just yet. And Pete was pretty good on it.
Pete wasn't. Well, I was unfair to Pete. I was doing like hi hats with Pete before I just do like a hi hat.
Pete knew him too. That was what was crazy.
Right.
I was going to ask you about your second album because that was the one for me. Like, I mean, that was like my album. It was, you know, I was, I think, like 16 when that came out. Right. And of all your singles, man, The Hiatus.
Right.
Bro, like, talk about putting out that album at a time because this is 97.
Well, 97.
It was 97,
right. Yeah.
So this is like the hit. This is like Bad Boy. You know, like right. all of that. What radio was. So how did you figure out kind of your lane in the midst of all that?
Well, the plan was to just, you know, still do Diamond D, but have a little more radio accessible joints compared to Stunts, Blunts, and Hip Hop. I did the joint with Veronica Cream and Sunshine. She was signed to Mercury Records at the time.
Okay.
But yeah, good memories. The Hiatus. A lot of people thought that I sampled Swahili Land for that.
And I was Gene showed me that record.
I was like, nah, bro, it's not that. You know, hey, me and Dilla, we both influenced each other. You know, Dilla has gone on record to say I was one of his influences. You know, the same with Pete, same with Premier. You know, we all influenced each other, but that was not Swahili land. You know, for those who know where the sample came from, y'all know. But yeah, and you know, that album, what I learned was in the process of recording that album was, you know, we all want to be signed directly to a major label. But in hindsight, I should have stayed with the label that signed me, which was Chemistry. I should have stayed with them because they were the cheerleaders. And when I was on Mercury, I was just another artist. They were excited about me, but they weren't as excited as the people at Chemistry Records were.
Chemistry, they were your translators for Mercury. Like they,
right. Well, I was signed to Chemistry first. You know, Brian Chin was over there.
Yeah.
So he was the one fighting for me. Once I'm with the Mercury, you know, Hanson is over there. Brian,
oh, wow. No. Yeah, because it's Brian the middle of nowhere. Yeah,
Brian, right. Oh, no.
Vanessa Williams.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
Blase,
they did.
Blase.
I think the only... They had, I think the only, they had, it was Ill Al Scratch still over there at that time?
They were over there. You know what I mean?
The Roots were almost there.
Word.
Oh, really?
We, remember I told you that we got the contract and they misspelled our names?
Right. Mercury?
So, yeah, Brian and Kenyatta Bell.
Kenyatta Bell.
We signed. We even went to the Jingle Jangle, right? We went to the Jingle Jangle video shoot that Friday. They took us out to dinner. And we're like, yo, man, we're going to be down with Black Sheep and everything. And this is the first time I'm hearing Jingle Jangle.
Right.
And that the way the piano just dropped down and shit, we just like, yo, we made it. We made it. And we get the contract. And because they misspelled me and Tariq and Malik's names.
Yeah, of course.
That.
Clerical error.
Right. But crucial error because I guess when three or more people in the party are misspelled, they have to give you a new contract. Kenyatta's assistant forgot to FedEx us Thursday to Friday, the new contracts. Okay. So they were like, all right, look, we'll send it Saturday delivery. You'll get it Monday. Go you'll ahead. Be cool. And they gave Wendy Goldstein enough time to land a plane and we horse and pony show. We didn't think we was going to sign to this shit. Right. So we just asked for the world and she gave it to us. And we were like, we're going to Geffen. Right. And literally that's what happened.
That might have been the better move anyway, in hindsight.
I'm still here.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My name is Johnny B. Goode. And I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to ask you two specific records, two of your favorite records in your catalog for me. Pharaoh Monch, Shine.
Ah, right. People don't mention that record.
Man, listen.
They mention The Light more.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, right. We can talk about The Light, but yeah, like Shine, that was the one.
Yeah, Monch was like, yo, you got something for me, D? I was like, yeah. So, you know, I sent them like two joints, and I was one of them. I didn't really make it necessarily with him in mind, but I knew something like that that's bouncy, the way the bass line bounces off the keys and the xylophones, that he might like it. You know, and that's one of my favorite joints that I ever produced.
Nah, that joint, I love that record. That one, and also as well, oh my God, I just lost it. Well, The Score, but it's a recent one. It's Magic. Evan, with Al and Al, and Evan Al.
Right. It sounds like Nautilus, but it's not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Talk about that one, man. Was that just, you just sent it to him? Like, how did that come together?
Yeah, I just sent them the joint, and, you know, the Step Brothers, that was Alchemist and Evidence. And they were like, yo, we want to touch this one up.
Yeah.
And once they laid the vocals, I added the, what's the name of that group?
It's Magic.
Right. Well, what's the name of the group? That's bad.
It's something for?
The Fearless Four.
Right. We will disappear.
Yeah. But that's when it came together.
Yeah.
Dude. But, that's crazy.
We got to talk The Score, though. I mean, we got to, like, The Score.
Wait,
so.
I got to kind of mention something.
Yeah.
Even though there was like a little friend, there was a little occasional friendly jabbing between the two groups.
What groups?
The Roots and the Fugees.
Oh, okay.
But you know, it's weird because in this age of misinformation, you know, you hear something and you think and you act on things without verifying first.
Right.
Like mad people get in our ears, like, yo, man, I heard the Fugees say something. But everybody was in our ears the day that The Score came out. And at the very beginning, Wyclef says, you rock it live, but you ain't saying nothing. Dee, 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 dee. And yo, that, like, if I could just go back and tell 24-year-old Amir Tariq, like, dog, verify some shit first before you bust a shot out. Right. But in our minds, like, we were already hearing shit. I mean, again, we were friends.
Personally.
We toured together. We were friends, but right. It was definitely like, oh, they going to blow up for real. Yeah. And when we heard that, we're like, yo, you think that we had, like, conversations like, yo, are they talking about us? You rock it live, but you ain't saying nothing. Whatever.
Oh, wow.
That's from one of the earlier records.
I know
that.
That
was a scratch.
Now,
yeah.
So shout out to Salam Remy for putting me on. But it was after the fact. And so we might have made a song called What They Do.
About that. So that's I never knew.
And ironically, today is the 26th anniversary of Ill Adolphe Half Life. Someone had to remind me.
Congrats.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, happy anniversary.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, but talk about have you ever played a beat for an artist that they fronted on that you had to give another artist or
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Like who should have gotten what?
I'm not going to name names, but yeah,
never
it happened. Yeah, no, but it happens, you know, somebody passed on something and somebody, you know, hey, it's just like women, right? Was one man's trash, the next man's treasure.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Just like men.
Yes.
Right.
Yo.
Definitely. That too.
From downtown.
No doubt.
Damn. You shot that right it. The last second.
Man, Steph.
Dude,
yeah.
Before we wrap, I got to talk. Dude,
let's do it.
For me, man, first of all, can you on streaming? I can't find Grown Man Talk nowhere.
Yeah, it's not on there.
And that to me,
I gotta put it on there.
You must.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I feel
you always
like,
liked 50 Ways.
No, time will heal you.
Time like that
whole.
Heal, yeah,
no,
yeah,
no, no,
yeah.
No. Just the whole joint.
The whole
like,
joint,
like
okay.
Us.
Right, 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 right.
What
right.
Y'all hitting? Like just that whole joint.
Yeah.
Because it came
it was
from
a mixtape. Yeah.
But it was so unexpected, and
right.
I wasn't expecting it.
Right.
And but for you, why do you? Because even with the rear view, like you're still. After a while, like after album number 5 or number 6, most cats might just phone it in.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, all right, you'll give me like $7,000 for a quickie record here, whatever. But when I still hear your stuff, it's like you still care.
Right.
And, but for you, like, what keeps you motivated? Like, in your mind, are you like, yo, I'm going to fuck somebody up with this in the way I flip?
yep.
Like, even the way you did the joint with Pos on Review with the Flying High Commodores joint.
Right, right, right.
That killed me, man. Because I didn't even think about that shit. But, like, how long have you had that in your pocket?
Flying High?
Yes.
A while. It's always been back here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just never really got to it. And then when I approached Paz, he said, "Yo, send me a joint." I said, "You know what? I'm gonna flip that. I'm gonna flip something that I can hear De La Soul on." And that's definitely I can hear De La on. And you know, as soon as he heard it, he sent me the verse back maybe like 48 hours later.
Wow.
Yeah, just like once a year, somebody will loop something. That's just like.
Right. It's not a loop. It's just different parts.
Well, not loop, but just use
a part you mean.
That just like, why not think about this shit?
Yeah. Oh, man, I got to ask you. Ed OG busted and Alcoholics the Next Level.
Yeah. The bass line.
Talk about
it. You know what? Yeah. I forgot about that, but somebody brought that up to my attention not too long ago. I guess because Ed OG's version didn't really do what it's supposed to do. I changed the drums up.
That's right.
I changed the drums up, and the licks picked it up from there.
Wow.
You know, I'm gonna tell you something else that y'all might not know. There's a song by Sadat X called Petty People.
Okay.
You know that song?
No.
It's on the Wild Cowboys album.
I got it.
Pull it up real quick. Play a quick second.
All right.
I made 2 beats on this day. That was one of them. And the score was the other.
Wow.
Yes. Okay.
But I kept the same drums.
EX, and this is for my people in the rule where I grew and went to school like this.
I remember this joint.
Right.
I remember this.
Yeah. That is. It is. Wow. Okay.
But also.
Live in a glass house. Don't.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of Ed OG, man.
Yeah.
The Streets of the Ghetto joint, man.
Oh, that was crazy.
But this is what I want to ask you, because that specifically, how were you, like, what is your micro-chopping game into? Because there will be some joints that will fluctuate speed-wise and as far as looping.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to know that the source of that sample is one of them things where I can't loop it perfectly, and my chopping game wasn't good enough for that. You know, it wasn't like we had Ableton to just stretch a joint or whatever.
Right.
But like, how aggressive are you to force something to work? Because that's definitely one of them joints. Because it wasn't the looping part.
Right.
It's just the fact when you got to add drums and everything on top of it, then you realize, oh, my shit might be off or whatever.
Right.
And that's that particular loop on Streets of the Ghetto.
Right.
That, and I'll play a little bit.
Right.
That's the, even there, I hear a little gap in there. But for you, like, how determined are you to make some shit work? Like, as far as your chopping game and
I mean, if I can loop it, or if I can create a loop, I'll be able to put the drums under it. You know, that's the easy part.
It sounds easy to just the regular ear,
right?
But knowing the frustration of there's some records in which you might find that magic four bar loop,
right?
And then they might fluctuate or whatever, and unless you're good at micro chopping, you might be asked out.
That loop right there, that was just a 2-bar loop, and the drummer was pretty on point for that. But there are some joints where the drum is a little off. And you have to really, like, go in between.
Right.
You know, and do what you do.
I feel you.
Yeah.
You came to Atlanta. You know, and there's a slew of New Yorkers that have migrated down south. A lot of them in North Carolina and whatnot.
Right.
What is it, like, what is it about this city that attracted you to come here? And do you feel
honestly,
like a stranger?
Just,
in this?
I didn't come here for the music. I came here because, you know, I looked at what $300,000 would get you in New York, and I looked at what $300,000 would get you down here. I didn't come down here.
That's
for
everybody's first motivation, for real.
I didn't
real.
Come down here for the music.
Yeah.
I was already coming down here doing a lot of work with Dallas Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Joy, Shades of Lingo, Illegal, me and Eric Sermon. So I was, you know, I was already down here. But the house
I
had,
yeah, you did Crumb Snatchers.
Crumb Snatchers. I had a nice house in not far from Livingston, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Nice spot. I sold that.
Property
came
tax
down
crazy
here.
In Jersey,
right? No, and just what you were able to get for your money back then is what really led me to come down here.
How long have you been down here?
Since 2009.
So you've been down here for a minute.
Yeah.
You're from the A.
So do you feel like a stranger in a strange land based on what you do for a living? And
well, you know what? All right. They don't, you know, Boom Bap does not thrive down here. There is a Boom Bap scene here.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there?
Yeah.
So when you do your 45 sets and all that stuff.
Right. I don't really do them here. I travel and do them. Okay. You know, I have done 45 sets here, obviously. But just as far as being an artist, you know, I'm still basically, you know, a Boom Bap artist, for lack of better words. So, you know, if you're a Boom Bap artist, you know, you live on Sirius XM. You got to just be comfortable with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, it's just real talk. It doesn't matter if you live in Atlanta or any other southern city or West Coast
That's
city.
Your platform. Yeah.
Right. It's just the music that I do.
Is it hard to not get influenced by the culture? Like, we've spoken to DJ Drama, who was like, yo, I'm straight backpack, blah, blah, blah.
One time,
but once he moved down here, it's like, okay, well, I got to adjust.
Yeah, well, yeah, he did what he had to do, and you see where he's at now. Mm-hmm. Shouts out to Drama. But, yeah, you know, hey, well, you know, Drama, when he came down here, he was a DJ.
Right.
I'm a producer, so it's a little different. Mm-hmm. But definitely, you know, it rubs off on you. You realize that, contrary to what people believe, there are people down here who can spit.
Right.
You know, whether, you know, it's trap or drill or boom bap, whatever.
Okay.
You know, just, you know, stereotypes are just that.
I feel you.
But, you know, it's a good balance for me to be down here because, you know, I'm up in New York almost every month anyway.
Okay.
You know, for the past 10 years.
Well, brother, man, thank you. We finally made this joint happen.
Yeah, no
and,
problem.
You know, I'm happy we finally got to come and give you your flowers and nerd out on your history and your catalog, man. Mm-hmm. I appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me, man.
Diamond D, ladies and gentlemen. Questlove right. Supreme. All right, so on behalf of Sugar Steve, Lightyear, Fontigolo, and Unpaid Bill, this is Questlove, this is the Immortal. Diamond D. We'll see you on the next go round of the Questlove Supreme. Peace. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday.
Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.